Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, we've got a conversation about Senator Mike Lee's visit to Russia. Also, stories about an immigrant activist facing deportation, how Uber and Lyft have disrupted transportation, and more. And joining me for this conversation, I've got Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, who is on the line from D.C. And good morning, Tommy. Welcome.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Thanks for being here. Also in studio, reporter Lee Davidson. And good morning and happy Friday to you as well, Lee.
And happy rainy morning to you.
Happy rainy morning. And Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome. Listeners, to join this discussion with any questions and comments that you might have, you can call us. We are at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet your questions and comments to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, as we speak, Senator Mike Lee is, I believe, in Russia. Senator Lee sought permission to go from the Russian government, and he got it. He got a visa, but that was not the case for a couple of other U.S. senators. Thomas Burr, there in Washington, tell us about this visit and why Lee was allowed to go to Russia when his Senate colleagues were not.
Yeah, so the original plan, it sounds like, was for Senator Lee and Chris Murphy, is a senator from Connecticut, Democrat, and Ron Johnson, who's a Wisconsin Republican, to head to Russia. You know, congressional members of Congress take these trips all the time. They're called CODELs, and, you know, they kind of fact-finding missions. There's nothing wrong with that to pretty much anywhere they go. Russia's a little more dicey. So in this situation, they obviously apply for visas to go as a part of the, you know, federal government delegation. And Mike Lee was approved while Murphy and Johnson were denied. So let's just go from the outset and note that Mike Lee was one of two senators, it was Rand Paul, who voted against sanctioning Russia in the for its interference in the 2016 presidential election, whereas Murphy and Johnson voted for those sanctions. This is obviously a little punishment from Russia to, you know, folks it doesn't like. Senator Mike Lee says he's going anyway. And let's add to that the TASS, which is a state, you know, Russian-owned news outlet, reported that Lee is going to meet with, I'll see if I can actually pronounce his name, Konstantin Kostyevez. He's is a Russian who was actually, who's under U.S. sanctions because of his involvement in the election interference. But Lee is going to meet with him. He is a, you know, Russian leader, the Federation Council. And so Lee is there right now in Moscow, meeting with these officials.
Can you remind us, you know, you mentioned the sanctions for Russia's interference in the 2016 elections, the fact that Lee voted against those sanctions, one of two senators. Can you remind us what that interference looked like? I know there was social media influencing, but there was also a kind of direct attack on the machinery of voting in the United States as well.
It was a massive operation. We found out a lot more, I think, with the Mueller report that came out not too long ago. Well, that was actually a little while ago. But we understand that they not only, you know, were setting up fake Facebook and Twitter accounts, trying to, you know, enrage people to the benefit of President Trump and to hurt Hillary Clinton. But they also, yes, there was an effort by the Russian government, according to the Mueller report, to actually hack into databases in states. There's been no proven case where they actually affected any votes through hacking into the databases, but it has been shown that some people were swayed by some of the social media efforts that the Russian government put in. So the sanctions were added by first President Obama, then Russia retaliated, and then U.S. Congress voted to sanction Russia even more so, including, you know, many individuals. President Trump has pushed back on that, and Mike Lee's argument against the sanctions was he doesn't think it's the right, I guess, solution to the problem, the right prescription in some ways. I wish I could be as fly on the wall in Moscow right now. It'd be fascinating to hear what they tell him.
What you know? What is he? You mentioned the fact that he's meeting with this this one official who is actually under sanctions from the U.S. government. What is the purpose of his trip in Russia? You said there. You know, we have these occasional trips where we go and do fact finding missions, but this is him by himself. Beyond this one official, who else is he meeting with? What's he doing?
Well, We assume he's going to meet with John Huntsman, who's a former Utah governor, of course, and current U.S. ambassador to Russia, who's outgoing, by the way. He's leaving fairly soon, I believe, in about a month. He's going to meet with him, I'm assuming, other business leaders. You know, Lee's office says that it's good to talk about trade, military relations, religious liberty, other issues important to both countries. This, again, it's not abnormal for this to happen. It's abnormal for a senator whose colleagues are denied still goes. I think John McCain, Gerke wrote about this, right, actually, but I think John McCain actually wouldn't, he was not approved and others were approved. Gerke can tell the story, but there was no question Lee was still going no matter what.
Let's bring Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke in on this. And you wrote about this trip in your column. Yeah. You actually had a litany of reasons why Lee shouldn't go, among them the fact that, you know, Russia had denied visas to these two Russians. But tell us the story of John McCain when he was denied a visa.
Well, Russia has had blacklists of U.S. officials who were not permitted into the country for a number of years. And it's included some, you know, McCain being one of them. McCain has been a vocal critic of Vladimir Putin, called him
a
butcher.
Robert, I think you and I are on the blacklist.
I don't know. Maybe you are, Tommy. I think I could still know. and McCain took it. He said he took it as a badge of honor that hostile renegade power would not allow him in, and he also kind of joked that he gets to spend his Easter break in Sedona instead of Siberia. There have been a number of people in the past who have been denied visas or because of their criticism of the Russian government. And in this instance, these two, Chris Murphy and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, the Republican of Wisconsin, so it's a bipartisan blacklist, were denied. And the thing that struck me about it is those two guys are both members of the Foreign Relations Committee. Mike Lee isn't. Mike Lee's not really on any of the relevant committees to the issues that are he's going to be discussing. My view of this is that it makes more sense for him not to go, to show a little solidarity with his Senate colleagues and to sit down and meet with a country that is hostile to us, for one thing, but also has insulted the institution of the Senate and the United States. Plus, it's hard to see what good can come of this. Mike Lee is not going to be able to broker a deal to, you know, get Russia back into the G7, which they were expelled for after they invaded Crimea. He's not going to be able to, you know, broker a deal to get them back into a test ban treaty. There's just very little good that can come of this. And when, you know, you're sitting from the outside saying, well, you know, no good can really come of this, but it could be send a bad message, that we can be divided like this it's sort of a divide and conquer strategy, I think, by the Russian government. It just doesn't make sense for him to go. And I think the Utah voters kind of need to ask themselves, well, you know, do we want our senator to be the guy that Russia is okay with, you know, and after, given that they have had, as Tommy laid out, this coordinated extensive campaign to infiltrate the 2016 election. The special counsel Robert Mueller said they are going to infiltrate the 2020 election or attempt to infiltrate the 2020 election. And by the way, the Senate still hasn't voted on that 2020 election security bill that the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell refuses to bring to a vote. And Mike Lee has not said anything one way or another about whether he wants that brought up. And so, you know, it's a bad look. It doesn't benefit anybody except maybe Mike Lee, and it's, I think it's a, it sends the wrong message to the rest of the country and to the rest of the world that he's willing to, you know, go be a pawn in this game.
On the 2020 election, you pointed out the Mueller report saying that it's not just Robert Mueller. You've got FBI Director Chris Wray saying that Moscow, this was in the summer, saying that Moscow is working to interfere in the next presidential contest. Former Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats warned that the Putin regime would, you know, find new ways of messing with American politics in 2020. You also wrote that this is lending a level of legitimacy to Russia's defiant actions, this is your quote, that threaten our national interests, and just that his presence in Russia is a problem in and of itself. In your mind, Robert, was Lee's visa, you know, granted when the other two senators' visas were not, simply because of his vote against sanctioning Russia?
I mean, obviously, I can't say with certainty, but it certainly looks that way, that you know, denying the visas to these other two senators, who have, by the way, at least in Johnson's case, visited Russia before, that denying their visa was a little bit of a tweak, a little, you know, slap in the face to those two senators in particular. And then granting it to another senator sends the very clear message that, yeah, we're, you know, singling you guys out because frankly, that they have been supportive of sanctions against Russia, which, by the way, I think every senator should have been supportive of sanctions against Russia. And all but two of them, Mike Lee and Rand Paul, were supportive of sanctions against Russia for, you know, for and if you consider what they did, the seriousness of what they did, it's a direct attack on the legitimacy of our democracy. You know, that's a serious thing. And to not even vote for sanctions, not even use your office and the voice that the one tool you have to to punish them or to reprimand a renegade power like that is, I think wrong. And then to go meet with them and you know, like that, I think is also a mistake.
And meanwhile, the rest of the international community is still standing in protest to the invasion of Crimea, as you pointed out. Thomas Burr, I want to bring you back in on this just for a second. You wrote that Lee isn't there as part of a coordinated effort. He's there by himself. He will, we expect, be visiting the outgoing ambassador and fellow Utah, John Huntsman Jr. Has Huntsman said much about this visit by Senator Lee?
No, he's not, and you can call me Tommy. It's totally cool.
Okay,
no,
thanks.
Either way. No, as far as I know, this is again, be fly on the wall, be fascinating. So, you know, John Huntsman, when he was governor, his general counsel was Mike Lee. He hired him and brought him aboard and kind of helped launch his political career. The two have not seen eye to eye on too many things. Some, yes, but necessarily they're not ideological kins when it comes to things. So it'll be interesting to see. I'm not sure how Huntsman perceives this trip, him going, but, you know, they'll probably be best buddies, and Huntsman being the diplomat he is, I'm sure he'll welcome with open arms and have a Diet Coke ready.
Is there any chance, I mean, Huntsman's leaving his post soon to come back home to Utah. Is there any chance that Lee is jockeying for the position of ambassador, Tommy?
That's funny. No, I don't think that's the case. And the president's already put forward a State Department top official to be the ambassador to Russia. It could be that maybe Mike Lee and John Huntsman will have a good conversation about whether Huntsman should come back and run for governor, the state of politics in the United States, since Huntsman's been, you know, away for 18 months, 2 years actually, almost now. So, you know, it would be interesting to see what they discuss. Huntsman's probably not going to ever, you know, call him out for the trip, because that's not what you do as an ambassador, but he's going to be cordial.
Okay. Anything else from your reporting on this that we should keep front of mind, Tommy, that we're missing from the story?
You know, as usual, when it comes to these kind of trips, the most we're going to learn is going to come from Russian state-owned media. We'll hopefully get a readout from Mike Lee when he gets back, and, you know, what his visit was like and what he learned and how his conversations went. But Russia is good about spinning, and so they're going to be the first ones out with, you know, some news report about the meeting and what he said. That will be interesting to follow, you know, the tit for tat of how that's going to go.
Robert Gerke, any final comments on this before we head to a break?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I just think it makes the most sense for our senators and our country to respond to Russia with a unified front, leave the diplomacy to the diplomats, and if you're going to be used as a tool, then maybe you should not make the trip.
Okay. Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune there. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Thomas Burr. Lee Davidson and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. 801-355-TALK is the number to call. That's 801-355-8255. You can also post your questions and comments to a tweet. Tweet to us at KCPW. I am now going to bring reporter Lee Davidson into the conversation. And Lee, you this week wrote about Cecilia Figueroa, an activist and immigrant here in Utah. She was facing deportation this week, kind of unexpectedly. Maybe to begin with, you can tell us just who this woman is. I mentioned that she's an activist, but how did she get to Utah, and what kind of activism are we talking about, Lee?
Well, she's a volunteer for Comunidades Unidas. She is a psychiatrist by trade, and she's known as a volunteer who helped residents access health care, education, and nutrition. She's also a volunteer at the Guadalupe School. So she's well-known among the community. And she had a routine visit with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. She thought it'd be routine, but they informed her that she was under arrest or being detained and had to leave the country. ICE says that for humanitarian reasons, they released her on the condition that she agreed to leave the country by Labor Day. And humanitarian reasons means that she's able to get her affairs in order, pack up, get ready to go.
Why, I guess, first, maybe I should ask this question. Why was she facing deportation? How did that order or reality for Cecilia Figueroa come to pass?
Well, according to ICE, back in 2008, she was arrested twice for illegally entering the country and was given what they call, I forgot what they call it, but essentially an order to leave. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of put in abeyance for 11 years, and she's been here that long.
Okay.
And so, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that, I mean, there was this protest about, you know, over her detention that took place, or over her possible deportation, really. This was organized by immigrant advocates and kind of came together really quickly and sort of showed the position that she had in that immigrant activist community. Can you talk about that and what this protest did?
Yeah, a week ago at ICE headquarters in West Valley City, about 150 immigrants and friends got there to protest, saying that she had never been offered the ability to apply for asylum. Their contention is that when you're ordered to leave the country, they're supposed to ask you, do you have any fear for returning? And she does. And they were urging ICE to delay things to allow her to pursue asylum. Didn't happen, however. Hmm. So,
right. ICE says that she's still, quote unquote, at large. These activists and immigrant advocates say something different.
Right. She had agreed to self-deport by Monday. She didn't do it. So I said, we consider her to be at large. She didn't keep her word. Friends, Luis Garza, who is executive director of Comunidades Unidas, it's a group that helps immigrants, put out a very short written statement that said, as of now, Cecilia will be staying in the United States out of custody to continue her asylum case. Well, she hasn't actually filed one, as far as we know. Anyway, he says it'll be a long and difficult process, but we will all be behind her to support her. We will not be able to comment on specifics about her case as the legal process continues. Probably worth mentioning is that protesters say that Cecilia has kind of become a poster child of what happens with new Trump administration policies. In the past, they especially targeted people who were here who committed felonies. They would especially go after them to try to deport them. That policy has changed to where the administration is saying, okay, if you're here illegally, doesn't matter if you're a felon or not, you can be deported. We may be coming after you.
And this was, I mean, basically enforcement policy, you know, how?
Right. Okay. And they say, well, this is a person who's been helping out here. She volunteers everywhere. She helps people. Never had other legal problems, and they've gone after her. And, gee, this is an example of what's happening. And I should also mention that she says she fears for her life and that of her family. She had issued a statement that was read at this protest where she said she had a nephew who was kidnapped in exchange for money that her family didn't have. And after a while, his decapitated and dismembered body was found. And she said when people return to Mexico from America, these bad people where she lives think that they have a lot of money, and she fears that more members of her family be kidnapped because of it. And so she says that's one reason she's not going back.
And part of her, well, presumed and pending, I guess, asylum case. I want to bring Robert Gerke, news columnist, in on the conversation here. And Robert, the context matters. President Trump, as Lee pointed out, has a different way of enforcing immigration.
Yeah.
He's also tried to take unilateral action to keep people who cross the border, you know, without explicit legal permission from even seeking asylum when they're here. There's raids and so on. I guess just your thoughts on the story of Cecilia Figueroa.
Well, I mean, I think she could be one of the many poster children for a broken immigration system, because we should want people in this country who are contributing to their communities and have contributed to their communities, and we should want people who come here and contribute to our society, our economy, you know, through the work they do. And more we're seeing examples of cases where the people who are being deported are not the people that who, as the president says, are criminals, rapists, and murderers. They're people who are who have given back and have established roots and a life here and are being denied an opportunity to try to do it the right way, right? So I think this is unfortunate. We've seen raids in different places where factory workers are being deported, and we're seeing families separated again. And it's it's easy to blame Trump for this, by the way, but this is a problem with our immigration system that both parties for decades have not been able to get their arms around, and there's no sign that they're going to either. I mean, this is something that we're going to continue to have to deal with. But bringing it back down to Cecilia's case, it's been encouraging, I guess, to see the community come out in support of her. But she is just one of many, many people who are dealing with this sort of thing on a day-to-day basis.
Lee Davidson, I was going to ask where Cecilia Figueroa is now, as she presumably, you know, waits to see her asylum case processed.
Somewhere in the country.
Somewhere in the country, right.
We don't know.
Yeah. I mean, is she in hiding? Does she have to be to try and avoid deportation?
Well, if ICE finds her, they will detain her and deport her. And so I imagine she has to keep a very low profile wherever she is.
Before we move on to other stories, I just want to quickly squeeze in another related piece of reporting that you did this past week, Lee. It was about a claim from the president about immigrants in the United States, and it was a claim that you could disprove. It has to do with the number of migrants who show up for immigration court and some words that the president used to describe that and what the reality is. Tell us about that, Lee.
Well, the administration for months, probably longer, has insisted that it needs to detain people at the border or wherever, because if they don't, they disappear into the shadows and we never see them again. Vice President Pence said that 90% of people who are released from detention don't show up. And the Secretary of Homeland Security said similar things, that it was around 90% of people that they track, you know, just don't show up. It's quite the opposite, actually. And a variety of groups have pointed that out nationally, but we looked at the numbers for immigration court in Utah. And 83.5% of immigrants who were once detained but later released appear at all their immigration court hearings. Other immigrants have even a little bit higher rates. People who are never detained show up to 86% of their hearings. And, of course, those who are detained show up to all of theirs.
Right.
There's some significant reasons behind that. If you miss a hearing in immigration court, you are ordered in absentia to be deported. And essentially, you lose all your ability to fight to stay here. And if you ever reenter again, it prevents you from doing that. It hurts you in a lot of ways. So immigration attorneys really try to get their people to all of their hearings. Some who are afraid they're going to be deported in any way disappear. Mm-hmm. But the vast, vast majority of them show up to all of their cases, despite what the president's saying. And let me explain one of the reasons. They use a really weird statistic to make their claims. They only look at cases that have been decided to this point. And so if you've missed your hearing, that decides your case. You're ordered deported. And so of all the people who, say, entered 6 months ago, the only cases that are decided are essentially those. And so, you know, it takes a long time to work through court otherwise. And so it looks like, gee, 90% didn't, you know,
but
show
it's,
up.
But it's not 90% of the whole.
No.
Yeah, okay.
It's just 90% of those that have been decided so far.
Robert Gricke, you know, the claimed statistics about immigrants versus the actual facts, they are often worlds apart. A crime comes to mind as well.
Yeah, I mean, facts don't matter, I think, in this, in a lot of ways. It's the administration is using voodoo math to try to prop up a point that they're trying to make, and it's unfortunate. You know, you want to see the facts and the data driving the debate, but in a issue that has been so inflamed, I guess, by the president's constant rhetoric, it's important, I think, to do the type of reporting that Lee did and get beyond that point, to get beyond the rhetoric and get to the actual substance of the issues, because really that's where we want to be having this debate, is on the substance of the issues. And if people are showing up to the next step is, if people are showing up to these hearings in an overwhelming numbers like Lee's data shows, then the detention becomes less important, less significant. I mean, maybe there are some people that would need to be detained, people who have missed hearings before or whatever, but the overwhelming majority of these people do show up to their hearings because they are ultimately trying to stay in this country long term. And the only way to do that, as Lee pointed out, is to show up.
Okay. I want to remind listeners to join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can tweet us at KCPW with your questions and comments. And actually, on that front, a comment on a previous story from Brenda Shear, who says that this has to do with Mike Lee traveling to Russia. She says, if two of my team members were denied entry to anything, a club, a stadium, a hotel, I would show my team that we are one and refuse to go to E Pluribus Unum. Whose team is Lee on? That's from Twitter. Again, you can comment. You can tweet at us at KCPW with your questions and comments as well. I want to turn now to a vastly different topic than what we've been discussing so far today. And for this, we will bring Thomas Burr back into the discussion. Tommy, this is a story about Hill Air Force Base and also about President Trump's border wall dreams. Both of those two things together, and they are tied together, of course, by money. Tommy, you wrote about the proposal to defund various military projects in Utah to pay for the wall. What's the gist of that story?
Yeah, so there's many projects. I think 23 states, military projects in 18 countries, a couple that are just worldwide projects. And it goes as far as, it could be, there's actually like a daycare at Andrews Air Force Base, a hangar at that holds Air Force One, projects that have been, you know, slated to start next year. And the president has taken that money using a very arcane kind of military law that says that, you know, during national emergency, you can direct money to different projects. So in Utah, there's two things at Hill Air Force Base that we kind of assumed would be on the chopping block, and they were. So it's about $54 million the president's going to take. There's $26 million for a composite aircraft antenna calibration center. I'm not really sure what that is, but I assume it has to do with antennas. $28 million for the Utah Test and Training Range Mission Control Center. They plan to redo that building, build a new one, something like that, next year. Both of those are now postponed until Congress reallocates money to do that, because the president is taking that money, adding it to all those others, and pulling $3.6 billion out of the military to build a wall that I believe Mexico one point was going to pay for.
$3.6 billion from $3.6 billion. That's nationally, obviously. This is $26 million
internationally, technically.
Oh, internationally, sure. And then $54 million from projects here in Utah. Or no, is it more than that from projects here in Utah? Sorry, Tommy, I'm just getting the numbers confused. Mm.
No, you're fine. It's $3.6 billion overall, and so from Utah, it's $54 million that the president is redirecting to the border wall from Utah. But there are a lot of other projects in various states, including some states like Arizona, where there's a Republican seeking re-election. Kentucky, Mitch McConnell is the Senate Majority Leader, and he's losing a ton of military projects. And these are jobs. So let's just take it down to jobs. So instead of construction workers in Utah building these facilities here at Hill Air Force Base, the money's being redirected to Texas and New Mexico and Arizona.
The national emergency declaration that you mentioned, can you remind us what that is and what it did? I mean, it allowed this reallocation of funding to happen, but what is the basis for the national emergency declaration that Trump issued?
Yeah, sure. Just to back up a little bit. So the president, of course, during the campaign, said we need to build the wall. Mexico's going to pay for it, build the wall. Mexico's like, yeah, right, we're not doing that. And then he went to Congress late last year and said, give him my money to build the wall. And Congress said, no. And then, as we all remember, the government partially shut down for about a month. And then eventually the president caved and the government reopened and Congress pretty much gave him $1 billion or so. I think it was $1.5 billion. For the border, but not necessarily to build a new physical fence. So the president, trying to take a win from that, essentially signed an executive order saying there's a national emergency on the border, and therefore we need to redirect military funds because it's a national security issue. So we need to redirect these funds to protect the border and fulfill his promise to build the wall.
All right, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke, having heard all of this, Tommy pointed out the idea that the president in campaigning said that Mexico would pay for it. And then just the idea of the wall in general and what it does. Go ahead.
If you don't mind, I want to start with Mike Lee and Mitt Romney, who are, expressing their outrage, their shock and outrage that, Trump is doing this. And only if they could find somebody who has the power to actually pass a budget or disapprove funding, because, maybe they should write a letter to their congressman. I don't know. They did make one point that I think is valid, that this is all happening because Congress has abdicated its constitutional responsibility to pass budgets and to deny funding for projects and to control the lawless exercise of presidential power that Mike Lee has ranted about for the last decade. This is the president is taking this money and it's going to start impacting military programs. And that's, one of the things I saw this week was that some of the money is coming out of military construction projects in areas that are now in the path of a hurricane, the actual path of a hurricane. We're not talking about Alabama. At some point, Congress has to stand up and exercise its constitutional prerogative to put a check on the president's power on this. And until they do, you're going to get things like this, and you're going to get this, pursuit of the wall. Now, both Mike Lee and Mitt Romney support the wall. They both want to see it built. But this is not the way to go about doing it, and they're the ones who we send to Washington to try to put a check on presidential power like this.
Tommy, I didn't get your.
Can I just add?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to add in here. The very interesting part about this, and I'm trying not to editorial here. I'll let Gerke do that part. But Hill Air Force Base is in Congressman Rob Bishop's district, and he's retiring after 17 years. In Congress, maybe run for governor, we're not sure. But he's prided himself on how particular Air Force Base and how he's done so much for Hill and he sits on the Armed Services Committee. It took him until about 8 p.m. on Wednesday to respond to the president's action, where he pretty much blames Democrats for holding up border money and says it's not a big deal because we're going to fund this eventually.
Also point out, if I could, Tommy, that they did provide funding for border fencing, I think is how they referred to it, not a wall. Money that was put into the continuing resolution. There was money put into the original continuing resolution that reopened government. From what I understand, there is enough money there to do construction on the border wall for the next year and a half. But again, this is more about politics than actual, than actual border security. It's about Trump trying to get as much border wall built by 2020 so he can use it as a campaign talking point and talk about when he goes to run for re-election, talking about how many people he's deported, how much wall he's built, how many a really horrible, thoughtless actions he's taken as president that will rile up his base.
Again, news columnist Robert Gerke there with his commentary. I want to actually bring in a caller who is on the line. This is Nate from Scipio, who has a comment about immigration to the United States. And Nate, what's your comment?
Well, first of all, Obama was much better at deporting and has exceeded Trump by far. But my question is this. If there are 47 million immigrants in the United States of America right now, which represents 20% of the world immigrant population in a country that's 4.5% of the world's population, we're actually doing better in raw numbers and nearly in percentages than any other nation in the world welcoming people. But I want to advocate for one group of people that's largely ignored. Mr. Gerke talked about shouldn't we want, good people who contribute to society? Absolutely. But my question to Mr. Gerke is, what about a legal immigrant from Cambodia or, somewhere in Southeast Asia that clearly has more humanitarian reasons to move to the United States of America? Why should they be disadvantaged because they have a geographical greater distance? Because, what we're talking about are people who didn't follow the rules, and because they were geographically privileged, they could come here and work that way.
And by that, you mean adjacent to our country, the border, running up against the Mexico-U.S. border being right there.
Yeah, that is what I'm referring to. And I'm not against them coming here, but we have 128 million people who would move here this year, according to an extensive Gallup poll. And since we're only letting in about 1.5 million a year, which, by the way, is more than any other country, I'm not sure that I feel, overly excited about helping people who are both geographically and economically far more privileged than very poor people in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. That's my comment.
I'm going to have a columnist, Robert Gerke, who you direct the question to, respond to that. Robert, it's a complicated geographic question.
But I mean, you used at the outset the number 47 million, which I believe is about four times the number that most estimates are of the actual immigrant population.
We absolutely have 47 million immigrants here. Okay. You're talking about illegal immigrants. I'm talking about immigrants overall. There's no question. It's 47 million.
Oh, well, okay. Yeah. Well, I think legal immigration is not the issue we're discussing, though. Legal immigrants.
You said we want good people in this country. I hope you don't exclude legal immigrants.
No, and I think the policies that we were putting in place deter both legal immigrants, the type of guest worker visas for highly skilled workers are also being limited. The system's being overwhelmed. We're putting caps on refugees right now. You talk about bringing in poor people from sub-Saharan Africa, which I assume you mean Sudan, Rwanda, areas like that. We put a cap on that of 30,000 people a year, which is the lowest it's been since 1964. If you're talking about enabling people to come to the country for humanitarian purposes from countries that are war-torn, Cambodia, Laos, sub-Saharan Africa, like you mentioned, then those are refugee visas, and we put a cap.
No, they're not refugees. That's such a misperception of these people. No, they're highly educated. They're just hugely disadvantaged. Do you realize that Mexico's GDP is five times per capita the amount that the Lakota Nation has within the United States of America, and Mexico is above middle class for a nation.
Okay.
And so, my problem is, we imagine these people to be these uneducated refugees, but in reality, this is all driven by economics, both right wing and left wing, very, very selfish people who want workers who have no rights.
Okay. So I think we agree on this, if I could. I think we agree on this, that we want not an open door, but we want a door that allow people to come into this country. And we want to do it based on...
Can we have all 128 million people come here? And should people who violated the rules be ahead in line from those who keep them? That's my last question.
Okay, great. I think I'm gonna let Robert Gricke respond to that, and then we're gonna have to head to a break. And Nate, I appreciate your calling in and contributing to the conversation. Thank you.
I mean, I think maybe what we've illustrated here is why it's a difficult problem for us to solve as a country, because we were talking past each other there a little bit, and it's a much more complicated and nuanced issue than we need to deport them all and lead to, you
know. I'd also just note one thing. Most new immigrants now for the last several years are coming from Asia and not Central America and Mexico.
The legal immigrants you're talking about.
Total immigrants.
Immigrants, okay.
Hey, we're going to head to a quick break here, and when we come back, we have one more story to cover on the show. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gricke, Lee Davidson, and Thomas Burr. It's our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments. Again, the number to call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Lee Davidson, this week in the Salt Lake Tribune, you wrote about the disruptive force that is ride-hailing. Uber and Lyft came in not that many years ago and have upended the way that we think of and use transportation. And they've done that in a number of areas. That disruption is playing out in a number of areas. And that includes a place that actually, maybe just to begin with, Lee, we talk about Uber and Lyft coming in or these ride hailing services coming in and disrupting the taxi companies. We assume that that happens a lot. Your reporting found that actually the impact there hasn't necessarily been all that negative. Can you tell us, can you just actually start with that misconception about these companies?
Well, first bear in mind that Uber and Lyft have only been in Salt Lake City for 5 years. And they went from having 0% of the market for ground transportation at Salt Lake City International Airport to having 60% of it now. And a lot of their competition essentially has decided to copy their technology and their tactics. Among that is a taxi. Bill White, who is the executive director of the airport in Salt Lake City, weirdly also oversees taxi service and ride-hailing services. And he says that taxi revenues actually have not dropped, even though Uber and Lyft have grabbed all that market. He thinks that the market has just really expanded. He says taxis could have grown more, you know, if Uber and Lyft weren't there, but they're essentially pulling in the same amount of money they always did. He says the market expanded because maybe people who used to drop people off at the airport or things like that instead are taking an Uber and a Lyft because it's cheap and easy.
You pointed out, though, that they did, as you already said, kind of profoundly change how taxis operate, especially at the airport, but then also in terms of the technology they're using.
Right. Yellow Cab, for example, uses a smartphone app. You don't have to call for a taxi or try to hail them. You can pull out your smartphone like you would with Uber and Lyft, schedule them, they can come and pick you up, and you see how much it's going to cost and when you get there. One thing that did change with taxis here, when Uber and Lyft were, the legislature ordered that they had to be allowed at the airport. So the city decided to lift restrictions on taxis. There used to be three cab companies here, Yellow, Ute, and City. When they deregulated it, now there are like 560 of them. Many of those are only one-person cab companies, but they no longer have to use meters. There are no longer set fares for many of the areas they go. Because of complaints of overcharging, the city declared an emergency, and they put limits on how much could be charged within city limits. But say if you take a taxi to West Valley City or Draper, you know, it's whatever the taxi driver wants to charge you. And so they encourage you to negotiate that beforehand, which is another reason I think a lot of people went to ride-hailing services.
You also wrote, just speaking of the airport, you wrote that the emergence of Uber and Lyft changed the actual physical design of the new airport going in here, that's under construction now.
When the airport was designed, frankly, Uber and Lyft weren't here yet. And so now they've had to design it so that it has much more curb space for them. They're talking about doing other things that are done in some other places, such as perhaps when you reserve your Uber, you'll get a message saying, meet them in the parking garage at space number 823. They haven't decided to do that. That's one of the things they're looking at. There's another option they're looking at that you would be given a number and sent to stand in line. And when you get to the front of the Uber or Lyft line, you show the driver the number and he punches it in and he sees where you're going and, you know, what it's going to cost.
More like waiting for a taxi than hailing a specific car.
Right.
Another airport-related impact is that the Trax line, the $350 million Trax line extension out to the airport, because of these services like Uber, Lyft, ride-hailing, people aren't using that Trax line as much as maybe planners would have liked to have seen.
The airport director points that out, and he thinks part of the reason is Uber and Lyft are relatively cheap, and it's a quick ride to Salt Lake City, so why take Trax? But Trax is increasing in ridership, just not as much as they hope. Also, the Utah Transit Authority is copying Uber and Lyft in other ways. They are about to launch a pilot program in southwest Salt Lake County that looks a lot like Uber or Lyft. Again, you can use an app on your smartphone, and you can request a ride, which is a van. It may not come exactly to your house, but nearby. And the van will cost not per mile like Uber and Lyft, but a regular bus fare. And it'll drop you to nearby locations or take you to a transit stop. So it's kind of a mix of Uber and Lyft and regular transit. It's called microtransit. Also, even airport parking folks are copying Uber and Lyft. Park and Ride now has a pilot program where for a price, once you park your car, you might find a Lyft rider waiting for you to take you to the airport. They have a partnership with Lyft so that Lyft drivers can hang out at their parking lot. And part of that is when someone who's parking there wants a ride, you know, a Lyft rider picks them up. So instead of park and jet, it's kind of park and Lyft.
You know, overall, this is sort of like crystal ball into the future. You reported also that some people are predicting that because of these ride hailing services, people could be buying fewer cars in the future, or maybe are even doing that now.
I hear people say, well, you know, I'm not going to buy a second car anymore. My second car will be Lyft or Uber. In fact, the airport had a little tiny bit of problem when it met with bond rating companies. They looked at the construction of the airport and they said, gee, you're building this huge new parking garage. Are you really going to need it with Uber and Lyft? And they said, well, right now we need it. We can't build a new airport and have no way for people to get there. But yeah. Various planners are questioning whether in the future, you know, you need as much parking lot space downtown or for a particular apartment or whatnot. But we're not there yet. That's looking in the future.
Robert Kirky, just before we head to our underplayed stories of the week, do you want to weigh in on the, I mean, it's Uber and Lyft are still cars. It's still car infrastructure going into cities. The trains are suffering as a result, maybe. What do you think about
that? Yeah, I mean, it is still car infrastructure, and it still requires roads, and it still emits pollutants. And I have seen studies that, and maybe Lee knows more about this than I do, but if I have somebody pick me up at my house and bring me here and then pick me up here and take me to my house, that's actually four trips instead of two that I would normally take, that they actually increase the amount of wear and tear on the roads and pollutants emitted, not necessarily versus taxis, because a taxi would also have to make those same trips presumably as well. But, you know, so there are some considerations.
Or they're doing other trips. I mean, it's not four trips. They're making other trips in between.
Right. But it's, you know, there is still infrastructure requirements, and there is still air pollution, and there are still issues that, frankly, that they have to address dealing with the way drivers are paid and so forth. But it's a fascinating thing, and something, as Lee mentioned, that we hadn't really fully prepared for or thought of just 5 years ago.
Lee's got this in-depth look at ride-hailing services at sltrib.com and actually in the physical newspaper as well. But, Lee, I'm sorry, we're not going to get into the Wild West part of your story because we need to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. And do you want to kick us off, Lee Davidson?
I'll use one that mentioned that the local council of the Boy Scouts of America is laying off 21 people because the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints is pulling out of scouting, which they announced, but it becomes effective, I think, at the end of the year. And so the future of scouting in Utah is kind of much in doubt. More than 90% of local scout units were with the LDS Church. What happens to scouting now with that pullout? And you know, the church is coming up with its own program for young men. The fifth Sunday of the month, they're having a special meeting in congregations to talk about what the changes are. So that'll all be interesting to watch.
What the face of church scouting will look like, I guess. Robert Kirke, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
I'm going to highlight a story that Nate Carlisle did about a bill that's being proposed for the upcoming legislative session in January that would move polygamy from a down to an infraction. So basically, it would be the same as a parking ticket or a speeding ticket. And the idea behind this is that we have, you know, constitutionally we have to have a ban on polygamy, a law against polygamy in the state. But they're trying to make it much less severe and onerous because that way they think that people in polygamous communities are going to be more willing to come to help, you know, law enforcement if there's something going on there. Just bringing them out of the shadows a little bit more, as we've seen sort of over the last several years, incrementally moving in that direction. And so Senator Deidre Henderson is working on that legislation, and it's going to be an interesting debate come January.
Come January, check it out. Thomas Burr, quickly, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Sure, no problem. This morning, the government announced the economy's added 130,000 jobs, which is less than expected. That's 30,000 of those include temporary census workers. This shows some sign of a slowdown in the economy. I would tell you to watch your 401ks, but I'm not too worried because the president's going to take out his Sharpie and, you know, change some of his numbers, and we'll all be okay.
Thomas Byrd with a joke at the end of the show there. I'm going to go with a demonstration organized by conservative groups to protest a state law that says teachers can answer spontaneous questions from students about sex. They don't want teachers to answer those spontaneous questions. Teachers not answering spontaneous questions is an interesting prospect. Thomas Burr, Lee Davidson, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
And this is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks to our operations director, Jesse Ellis, for his work on the show and to the team at Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend.